From the heartland of America, the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world, I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, the American Stonehenge. Looking forward to that. Here's what's happening. U.S. authorities have prepared charges to seek the arrest of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. The Justice Department's investigation of Assange and WikiLeaks dates back to at least 2010, when the site first gained wide notoriety and attention for posting thousands of files stolen by the former U.S. Army intelligence analyst, now known as Chelsea Manning. Prosecutors have struggled with whether the First Amendment precluded the prosecution of Assange, but now they believe they have found a way to move forward. Assange remains holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy in London, seeking to avoid an arrest on assault charges and allegations in Sweden. In Paris, a police officer has been killed. Two others were seriously injured when a gunman opened fire before he was shot dead. Officials say the Islamic State group quickly claimed responsibility for the attack. North Korean state media threatened to launch a super mighty preemptive strike that would reduce South Korea and the United States, they say, to ashes. Let's check in with Dr. Jerome Corsi from Infowars.com. Boy, the rhetoric from North Korea, Jerry, just doesn't stop, does it?
George, it's ramping up every day. And now, yeah, even California, I think, is beginning to wonder, in addition to Hawaii, whether this is real or just more rhetoric. And the tension continues to grow. If there's the next test that North Korea does of a missile, I think could easily trigger a U.S. response. And we have enough military power in the area to launch another Tomahawk missile attack or do some similar kind of attack on North Korea bases that could launch a missile, or, you know, in the act of launching a missile. And I continue to say, George, it's very, very dangerous, could escalate, and could be extremely unpredictable. It's a very, very kind of tinderbox situation right now.
At what point do you think, Jerry, the generals from within North Korea quietly decide amongst each other, this guy's got to go, Kim Jong-un, he's got to go?
I'm sure that's a lot of the pressure that we're applying on China right now, and China seems to be backing away from buying coal from North Korea, other sanctions. But, you know, George, I'm not sure how much of this works when you've got essentially a crazy head of state who could, you know, unilaterally decide he's going to do an insane act and launch missiles or try to do a massive attack. And certainly Japan is within region. He has launched missiles aggressively before. The question is, if a missile starts to be launched, or submarines, which is another question, which, you know, what's North Korea's real submarine capability to launch a missile or even an EMP attack? It's an extremely dangerous situation. I think the rhetoric reflects the fact that the Trump administration is not willing to let this situation just drift, and that's what makes it extremely dangerous, because a confrontation could escalate very quickly.
Jerry, I'm going to put you on hold. Can you hold on with us for a couple of minutes longer?
Yes, certainly.
Okay, you do that, because I'm going to come right back after the break. We're going to continue chatting about this. This may be one of the most serious stories we've dealt with here in a long, long time. General Motors has stopped doing business in Venezuela after authorities took control of a factory in what GM called an illegal judicial seizure of its assets. The plant was confiscated as anti-government protesters clashed with authorities in a country that is rolling in economic troubles such as food shortages and triple-digit inflation. Americans are more stressed than ever. We've been talking about that now for a few weeks. But most of them, their bank accounts are to blame. The majority of Americans, 65%, are losing sleep over money issues, according to a new study. A potentially dangerous cobra is now roaming the streets of North Central Florida, and the worker who was supposed to prevent it from escaping is in deep trouble. Ian Nesmith, 28 years old, charged with a misdemeanor for letting the tan and yellow cobra escape from its enclosure from a home in Ocala. Preparations are underway for the launch of China's first unmanned cargo spacecraft on a mission to dock with the country's space station. They are really moving ahead in their program. What else is going on up in the skies? Let's check in with Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center. Peter, go ahead.
Well, in direct response to the question you pose, apparently a great deal is taking place, George, and it's been one of those weeks that makes me wish somebody would convince me that UFOs are not a reality so I could close my doors and bring this to a close. But it's been a wild week. We just posted 133 reports to our website that have been received over the last 7 days, so it's been a pretty active week. First report I'd like to start with is, frankly, it's a little bit alarming to me, George. 2 nights ago, I got a call from a very bright-sounding young woman who said that she was being followed by a UFO. Usually in cases like that, I discount it and assume that there are other things at work, not UFO-related, but she submitted, frankly, a superlative written report describing an incident just 2 nights ago. The 18th of April, she was driving home from Kent State after volleyball practice, and she became aware of a very strange-looking light that appeared to be tracking her car as she drove from campus to her parents' home in Akron, or close to Akron, Uniontown, I guess. She saw it once, and she was sitting at a red light. Suddenly the light turned green, and just as the light turned green, this object that had captured her attention just jumped across the sky, halfway across the sky. At that point, she panicked and gunned her car, trying to get away from the thing. She didn't see it until she got very close to her parents' house. Very, very interesting report, and I commend it to people's attention, posted to our website for the 18th of April. It's made particularly interesting, too, George, because of a similar incident that was occurring at the same time near Madison, Wisconsin. A young couple and their young 3-year-old son were driving east towards Madison on Interstate 94, and suddenly they became aware of a strange light ahead of them, very similar to the report from Akron, Ohio. They continued driving. They bought fuel and looked again to see if the lights were there. They were. And suddenly, one of the three lights that they were looking at moved very suddenly to directly above their car, at which time they got a very good look at it, and it suddenly accelerated and disappeared from their sight to the west, made a horseshoe turn just before it accelerated, so clearly not something that was made on this planet. I'm convinced of that. Finally, two very convincing, interesting reports from Newton, Alabama, which is on the southeast corner of Fort Rucker in the southeast corner of Alabama. A young couple were outside looking for the asteroid, and they saw a triangular craft directly above them. They saw it for only 5 to 10 seconds, but it left a deep impression on them, and people can see the very nice illustration that the young woman submitted. So there's a lot going on. And again, I hope somebody can convince me that these things aren't real, but from my chair, they certainly look like it.
They are real indeed. Peter, thank you. That's Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center. Now, all this talk of North Korea wanting to blast us away with nukes. Dr. Jerome Corsi is with us. Let's talk with him more about this when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast, George Dory with you, Jerome Corsi with us, Infowars.com. Jerry, there's so many things I want to talk with you about, and thank you for staying over here for a little bit with us. But back to North Korea for a moment. It seems like Russia's not concerned, China's not concerned about North Korea doing anything to them. Why are we having this issue with this country?
It's because of how belligerent this Kim Jong-un has been to the United States and to the West in general. Really, North Korea has been a client state of China since before the Korean War. So this dates back to the 1950s and actually to the end of World War II. when North Korea became a communist state, and we had the Korean War in the 1950s when North Korea invaded South Korea, and we actually, with the UN, agreed that we sent a military force, which was there for some 3 years, I believe, ended up in the decision to, you know, continue dividing Korea, North Korea, and South Korea. South Korea is not communist, and we continue today to occupy with military forces, some 30 to 50,000 troops, depending on the time, of U.S. presence in South Korea. So North Korea has always viewed the United States as a enemy and as a potential combatant, especially as North Korea now has developed nuclear and missile capabilities.
Jerry, China has basically sided with us in this tension, in this dispute. What do you think is going to happen here? I mean, as we move our aircraft carrier, the Carl Vinson, in the area, moving it away from Australia where it was headed, and it's going back to the Korean Peninsula now, is China going to intervene, or are they going to sit back and watch us do something?
Well, I think China is attempting right now to contain and control North Korea. North Korea is basically dependent on China for its economic survival, because North Korea has virtually no economy. It has coal and it trades with China, but it's very dependent on China for its food and other goods, and China has a lot of sway over North Korea because of this. Now, China has used North Korea as a client state to cause trouble. I mean, this is one of the difficulties where you see countries like Iran and North Korea who have been rogue states, and Russia has been very close to Iran, continues to be, and through surrogate states we've had, certainly in the Cold War and subsequent era, conflicts between the United States and Russia or the United States and China have been played out through these surrogates, which is very, very dangerous. The current situation in North Korea traces back to, I think, 1994, when under President Carter, there was an agreement with North Korea that Jimmy Carter, if you remember, intervened in, and they had an agreed-upon framework where North Korea was going to be part of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and under the United Nations, we were going to, with President Clinton, allow North Korea to have nuclear fuel for peaceful purposes. And then soon after we provided nuclear fuel and worked with North Korea on this, North Korea went rogue and started to develop a missile program. That's kind of a same fear we have with Iran right now, because the history of these states, like North Korea and Iran, is they promise that they're only going to use nuclear fuel for peaceful purposes. They join the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and then it emerges that the countries develop very significant nuclear weapons programs outside these agreements.
Why don't we send Dennis Rodman over there, the ex-basketball player?
I think Dennis has been over to China. I mean, he likes to go over and create some publicity from time to time. It's a very difficult situation. North Korea has really never engaged in serious negotiations internationally. They've always kind of gamed the international negotiations. So you have Secretary Kerry or others thinking they've engaged in negotiations. Certainly, President Clinton made a major effort in the 90s to try to get some agreements with North Korea which would contain their nuclear program, very much like President Obama has made recently with Iran, to try to get agreements in place where peaceful uses of nuclear fuel would be permitted, but with the agreement, the Iran or North Korea would not develop weapons. The problem is these countries have not adhered to these agreements. So now you've got, with North Korea, they've had at least, I think it is maybe 5 or 6 successful tests of nuclear weapons that date back to 2006. In 2016, there was actually an explosive device that North Korea exploded that they said was a hydrogen weapon. It was certainly a large weapon. I'm not sure it was hydrogen. It could have just been a very, very big plutonium bomb or even possibly a uranium bomb. But North Korea is claiming to have hydrogen bomb capabilities. The real question with North Korea is, what's their missile capability? And if you remember, George, the Scud, which was a weapon that was used even by Iraq going back into wars.
That's right. It even launched against Israel. That's right.
Right. It was one of the early North Korean weapons, but it's very limited in scope. The weapons they have, for instance, a UNHA-3, which could reach the West Coast, certainly could reach Alaska, but that missile has never really been successfully tested.
What about their submarines, though, Jerry?
Well, and again, their submarine capability, which they have, and we just don't know what the nuclear missile capability is.
Right.
See, it's one thing to have for a country to develop a bomb or to maybe one weapon, but what North Korea aspires to and what Iran aspires to, which is a nuclear weapons program, requires really very sophisticated technical capabilities, because you have to be able to miniaturize the nuclear warhead so it will fit on a missile, and the missile has to be reliable and able to be fired and hit the target. Now, these are just, they're simple concepts, but they're very technologically difficult to achieve. It's just like the ability to have a aircraft fleet, aircraft carriers. The United States still has the largest number of aircraft carriers that are operational, but it's very difficult for a country to put aircraft carriers around the world to maintain the logistics. I mean, these are like traveling cities, the thousands of sailors in a very complex operation, the same as with our missiles and submarines. And for a country like North Korea or even China, to really have a aircraft carrier capability or a sophisticated bomber capability or missile capability, I'd say China only in recent years is achieving real significant nuclear missile capability and is just beginning to experiment with aircraft carriers. You've got to remember, China is, in comparison to the United States, still a very small and relatively unadvanced economy, even though the population is so huge, and the future of China is probably to be, on a par with the United States and Russia as a superpower. China is yet not quite there. And that's, again, these are the kind of facts that people just reading the press often are not able to really distinguish, because the press will exaggerate the threat to North Korea, the threat to from China. The problem is with a rogue state like North Korea is you really don't know what they're capable of.
That's right.
Or just how dangerous they might really be. And that's what causes the extreme concern. I mean, do you really underestimate their capability and it turns out that they detonate a nuclear weapon in Hawaii or on the West Coast? I mean, these would be horrific and tragic consequences, and no president, I think, being responsible, would be willing to take the risk.
I agree. I mean, it would mean annihilation for the North Koreans, but do we want to take that chance?
And that's, again, these are the kind of calculations, George, that make it so difficult, because, we want to take limited steps, and if you were dealing with another rational regime, you could say, look, we're going to engage in sanctions, which could be economically difficult. We're going to engage in limited military steps, which would be impactful, in terms of putting greater capabilities in South Korea, anti-missile capabilities, for instance. But a Kim Jong-un, these might just be provocative steps that encourages him to become more adventurous.
You're right about that. Jerry, thank you for holding yourself over for a little bit to give us a little more information about this tense situation still in North Korea. Up next, Peter Ward joins me. We're going to talk about extinction, climate change, next on Coast to Coast AM. And in a moment, Peter Ward joins us as we talk about his work, climate change, extinction as well. Amazing stories from Peter coming up in just a moment. Some quick events I wanted to talk with you about this weekend. I'm going to be in Toronto at the Toronto Total Health Show. Full details at coasttocoastam.com. Hit the navigation bar up at the top where it says me, hosts, and look at George's events when it opens up. And the Toronto event is there. So if you're out there in the Toronto area, come on by this weekend. We're going to have a great time there. And also circle your calendar for July 29th up there in the Northwest Quarter. I'll be in Everett, Washington. Full information at our highlight reel at coasttocoastam.com for a live stage show. So you can either go to our website or historiceverettheater.org or call this number, 425-258-6766. And then lastly, on May 17th, lunch with me and Beverly Hills matchmaker Marla Martinson in Los Angeles. You can email your information, your phone number, to lunchwithgeorge@gmail.com. They've got a few seats left. lunchwithgeorge@gmail.com. And welcome back to Coast. Peter Ward back with us here on the program. Peter has been active in paleontology, biology, and recently astrobiology for more than 40 years since his PhD in 1976. He has published at least 140 scientific papers dealing with paleontology, zoology, and astronomical topics. He has been an acknowledged world expert on mass extinctions and the role of extraterrestrial impacts on Earth. He was a principal investigator of the University of Washington's work on NASA's Astrobiology Institute from 2001 to 2006, and in that capacity led a team of more than 40 scientists and students. Welcome back to Coast, Peter Ward. Peter, good to have you back.
Thank you, George, and good to hear from you, too.
Looking forward to this. You are so active. What have you been up to these days?
I've just been getting more and more worried, to tell you the truth. I'm doing stuff in Antarctica. We did four trips down there, and we're looking at just the nature of what happens when planets get too warm. And although we do believe the asteroid did kill off all the dinosaurs, more and more we're seeing that at the same time there was a great deal of volcanic warming. And so it's a lot of us are going back, and when the head of the Environmental Protection Agency says that carbon has no effect on climate, a lot of us are scratching our head, because certainly the fossil record and most scientific records suggest that carbon dioxide definitely makes the Earth hotter.
Sure does. Peter, what's going on at Antarctica anyways? We hear all kinds of stories that the Russians are down there building a base, we're down there building bases, something's deep underground on the ocean floor. What's happening there?
Well, you've got a couple of really unique environments, obviously. One of them is called Lake Vostok, and this is a giant lake that is the Russians have been studying for a long time. But Lake Vostok is covered. It's been covered by so much ice for so long that the water has not been in contact with the atmosphere for thousands of years or more. And the Russians, for the first time, are putting drill cores down into it. And the worry has been of contamination. I mean, most of our worry is, oh, gee, we're going to have our Earth microbes contaminating that deep lake. Mm-hmm. But what if it's the other way around? I mean, what do we know what's crawling down in that vat of cold water? So this is one part. The other that I thought was the most interesting news and scary news, the very deepest depth of the ocean is the Marianas Trench. And when I was a little boy, and George, you might remember this too, the Bathyscaphe, the Trieste, and a guy named Picard, and they were the first people to go all the way to the bottom of the Marianas Trench. Well, they've just gone back, and they took water samples, and this is the deepest, farthest part of the ocean. It's so far from continents. And yet they were finding pesticides and herbicides from common farms. Those molecules, which are definitely identifiable, have found their way into the farthest, deepest part of the ocean. So it is as if our chemical reach has now extended everywhere on this planet, to Antarctica, to the tropics, to the deepest part of the ocean. And once again, you ask, these are very bioreactive chemicals. are we, as I guess the fingerprints on those deep waters, are we building new types of creatures in these deep Antarctic lakes or in the deepest oceans?
And are they dangerous creatures?
Well, that's the question. You need to know first how quickly evolution is happening when you insert chemicals that were never naturally produced on Earth into these very pristine environments. There has to be effect, but evolution also responds very quickly to radical changes in environment. So what will we see being produced with these radical effects in these deep, pristine waters?
Peter, let's talk a little bit about what's happening with this new administration and how they are handling situations like this. What's your opinion in the short time that President Trump has been in office?
Well, I guess the whole conversation goes right back, and some of these questions are legitimate. How much of climate change, how much of carbon dioxide are humans putting into the atmosphere? And it's not just carbon dioxide, of course. It's also methane. But as atmospheres get warmer, as the planet warms, one of the great greenhouse gases, and again, greenhouse gases are those which actually, they're like a thermal blanket, and they warm the planet because heat can't escape. Water vapor, as we warm up a tropical region, water evaporates from the ocean, and these are added to methane and carbon dioxide to produce these greenhouse blankets. So the question is, if we were to turn off all the human sources, right, if there were no cars, no factories, none of this stuff, and just let the volcanoes do their thing, because volcanoes are largely where most carbon dioxide entering the atmosphere comes from, mm-hmm. that and recycling in and out of permafrost, for instance, how much would the whole thing drop? And this is where we're trying to say, if we cut off all human effects, will it have an effect? Will there still be climate change or not? How much of an effect will it have? And the administration rightly says that you really have a very difficult time at this moment making a precise percentage by which humans are doing this, because it's so hard to track how many cars are doing this, what's going on with the power plants. But I guess that you can say the qualitative sense, yes, we are important. And if we did turn off all of our heating elements causing the Earth to warm, we would probably go back into a much cooler world. We've been warming since the 1700s, since the Industrial Revolution. So if we stop all industry, all human endeavor, it cools off again. Is it cold enough to go into another ice age? A lot of us think that had there not been an Industrial Revolution, that the cycle was that we were about to go back, or not about to, but over the next few thousand years, would cycle back into the glacial, because we've been in mm-hmm. 1 to 2 million years of glacier, non-glacier, and that cycle seems to have been stopped by humans.
One of our guests, Peter, his name is Robert Felix. He's written a book called Not by Fire, But by Ice, and he believes that we're in an early stage of another ice age. What do you think of that?
Well, it's tough to know. I mean, if we're in an early stage of an ice age, then this is simply a warming before the much, much colder that's about to come. But gee, every record that we look at, and just trying to compare what happened in previous stages. So about 22, 23,000 years ago, the Earth plunged into the last great ice age, and it ended about 14,000 years ago. So we had this long period of ice. But we can watch through ice core records. George, these are these hunks of ice that people core down, and you can date them very precisely. So over the last 500,000 years, we can look at even yearly records and understand what it's like to go into an ice age and what happens when you go out of an ice age in terms of the gas percentages, the temperatures, how long those things take. It certainly doesn't look now anything like what it looked like going into those previous ice ages. But again, humans are added to the whole business, and I'm not going to stay here and say that's not possible.
Well, then let's talk about cycles for a moment too, Peter. I mean, there's no question this planet has had higher concentration levels of carbon dioxide even during the dinosaur times. And even though humans may be contributing somewhat to this, I think this planet's in a cycle, and these things are going to happen whether man is here or not.
Well, there's certainly cycles, and the one that people point to, because we just don't know, we haven't observed long enough, are the solar cycles. I mean, you certainly know that sunspots come and go. But look, we haven't been observing the sun for telescopes only came around from the 1600s. how much observation do we have in 500 years when you're talking about a planet that's 4.65 billion years? Nevertheless, it does really look like carbon dioxide seems to be one of the major culprits. Now, ice ages, they're certainly not anything new. We've had ice ages going all the way back to about 2.5 billion years ago. We had something called a snowball Earth, where the whole planet seemed to have been very cold for a reasonably long period of time. We had another snowball Earth at about 700 million years ago. During just before the age of dinosaurs, we had an enormous long glaciation. And then we have this one over the last 2 million years. So there have been glaciations in the past. And the most curious aspect is that some of these seem to have taken place when there had been, prior to them, very high carbon dioxide that radically reduced, letting ice come, and then carbon dioxide increased again and the ice disappears. We do have that correlation. I mean, we can measure what past CO2 was, and we can measure what past planetary temperatures were. So we do find this very, very strict correlation back and forth. But what makes the CO2 go up or down in the deep past? And how could it have changed so quickly? These are the unknowns.
Peter, our investigative reporter, Linda Moulton Howe, has been doing stories about the barrier reefs and how they are dying. If they die, it could be a disaster. One, why are they dying? And two, if they do, how can that affect things there?
Yeah, these are great questions. And I had a science reporter today asking me just that and say, can you say unequivocally, because if you go to the press, I mean, right away you go to USA Today or something else and they've got a quick response. They say, oh, the ocean's getting warmer and that's killing all the coral reefs. Well, just as climate has gone through cycles, we've seen cycles in reefs coming and going for many millions of years. And even in the last generation, again, going back to, I guess, my old age, Shilling George, I just do remember the supposed great threat of the crown of thorns starfish. And this was the strange beast on the Great Barrier Reef about 20 years ago. And everybody said, doom and gloom, the reef's dying, the starfish are going to eat the reef into nothingness. And then that great expansion of starfish just suddenly disappeared over 2 or 3 years. And it's like it never happened. So these are cycles. Animals come and go and come and go. And so I guess a null hypothesis is that barrier reef dying, and this is quite true. I mean, people that are doing these studies are able to do very, very intricate mapping of where there's living coral and where not. But we haven't done mapping more than, say, 50 years. And I'm asking the science reporter, and she's asking me, well, what about 200 years ago? Do we have any idea if such living and dying happened in any sort of cycles back then? And the answer is no. We haven't been looking long enough. What we do know from aquarium studies is that if you have water temperatures equivalent to those found on the Great Barrier Reef now, that the corals in an aquarium very quickly expel the tiny, tiny little plants they have within them called zooxanthellae. Corals only can make these gigantic skeletal structures because they have a symbiotic tiny little plant, thousands of them in every coral animal. So the coral animal still lives, but the tiny little plants within it die, and the coral can no longer make a skeleton. So sooner or later, erosion just knocks away. And we call it coral bleaching because the color of a coral comes from these tiny, tiny plants that are packed within its flesh. When it gets too hot, all the plants get out and leave this transparent animal behind. And soon after that, the coral animal itself does die. So this is what we're seeing now. It is thought to be related to temperature. But again, we need longer cycles to look at this.
Peter, let's talk a little bit about what you have talked about, and that is the possibility of mutated new animals that could be in the seas, all over the place. Now, the deepest spot on this planet is the Marianas Trench, right? How deep?
That's the Challenger Deep, I think it's called. I think it's, I may screw this up. Is it 17,000, 27,000? I should know this stuff. Several miles, more than several miles deep. And that you've got to get.
I know one thing, it's really deep.
Really deep. We're talking about so far that no light has ever been down there. I don't have my computer handy. I'm sure your listeners can tell us pretty quickly, but it's tectonic trench that is just this gigantic rift in the planet itself. And again, there's nothing else on our ocean water planet that is anywhere near this deep. And this is why this first study, I mean, this was the first time anybody had ever really sampled water from down that deep. The shock again was finding that chemicals we find everywhere on the surface and in lakes and the shallow seas had made their way down there too. And the hope had been that the deep ocean is insulated from some of the pollution that certainly is affecting lakes. And again, it was a really sad day, I think, to recognize that even the deepest part of the oceans are now accumulating these very complex organic chemicals. Now, some of these things are pretty nasty things. We know we have artificial estrogens, and at least in many animals, including humans, the thought is that these artificial human hormones are causing early maturation in men and women, and that our kids are reaching sexual maturity quicker, and that within animals themselves, that we've got indication of this too. One of the really sad aspects of where I live, Puget Sound, we're the home to a resident pod of killer whales, J-pod, and we've just found now that the flame retardant that is found in every computer, every mattress, every blanket, almost every set of pajamas is now infused within the flesh of these killer whales. So we're finding again that this flame retardant apparently causes lesions, it causes cancer, and every young killer whales has it. And then someone said, well, maybe we should look in humans next to where the killer whales live. And sure enough, mother's milk, human mother's milk, has huge concentrations of the same stuff.
Oh, passing it right on to the little babies.
There you go. So this stuff that we, and I guess maybe we deserve it since we're building it, but the fact that now it gets to the deep ocean, and not just the shallow areas where runoff from cities and streets can cause small bodies of water, such as Puget Sound where I live, open ocean now and deep ocean are being affected by the chemicals. But to finish up, you asked the most interesting question. What might the evolutionary, downfalls or effects of this might be? And that, I think, is a fascinating question still to be learned about.
I mean, we could be making the island of Dr. Moreau, all kinds of hideous creatures. Who knows what's going to happen to them?
Well, that's my thought, too, is that you've got this stuff pouring down in there. It's a little place, again, that was absolutely pristine. The same thing with this deep lake in Antarctica. It had this ice cover for so long, and now we have drilled a hole through it so that our world can be pumped into it and its world again coming back out. So you've got this two side of the equation. We're dumping all these chemicals that are making it to the deepest ocean. Maybe there's an express mail from the deepest ocean coming back at us within centuries. Who knows?
What kind of a job are we doing, Peter, as a world to try to minimize pollution?
You know, that really depends upon the amount of money that the average citizen has. In my lifetime, I've certainly been happy to see the radical changes that are so observable. I was in Los Angeles in the 60s and the 70s, and the amount of pollution in L.A., the smog there, was it really did burn your throat. Look at London, those killer fogs from the 1890s. That sort of pollution has gone away. But again, if you think about China.
China's got a lot of it now.
Terrible amount. And again, it is really related to how much of an effort does a government do to help clean this up. And this is not the sort of thing that a single citizen saying, I'm going to do my part, can do alone. These sorts of huge problems become of such large scale that only governments acting in concert with their citizens can make a change. I mean, Richard Nixon was the greatest environmental president in the United States history. I mean, he goes down as this villain to many of my generation, the baby boomers.
Well, he does.
But the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the Endangered Species, all this stuff came through Nixon because the Republicans in that time were the great environmentalists. And they pushed through all these great acts, and it had a huge effect. So we now have to really make some decisions about, I think, the great environmental challenge of our time, that carbon dioxide is a pollutant.
Peter, stay with us. We're going to come right back at the top of the hour. We'll continue chatting about your work, and also we'll take phone calls next on Coast to Coast AM.